just want to start by reiterating some of the things that Van Andy said. So, just come is the overall message. You're booked onto the course, so just keep coming. Even if you don't feel like coming, I bet you one night during the 8 weeks you won't want to come. I bet you one night during the 8 weeks I won't want to come. I hope that doesn't scandalise you, but it's just the truth. It's best that you know the truth. But I shall. Yeah. So just see if you can come. And as Banan was saying, if you then, an unimaginable reason don't come, don't get into a big guilt fest and think, I can't face them. You know, just then come the following week. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I want to introduce the first element of the course, and then I'm going to ask you to decide how you're going to practice for the following week, and then we're going to finish by ceremonially giving you the book. So the main thing to say about this course is we won't be doing a lot of meditation on the course. What we'll be doing mainly is introducing a whole element of practice, a vision of practice. I'll be suggesting some ways in which you can practice it during the week. I'll ask you to then go off and do that, and then the following week you'll come back to your home groups and talk in your group about how you got on with that. So the really important thing about this course, in my belief, is it needs to be really practical. What we'd like you to do, as Ban Andrew would say, is read the book so that you learn about a whole vision of life and that you actually then try and put that vision of life into practice. You need the both. You need to learn something and you need to put it into practice. Yeah? So what I'll be suggesting each week is kind of three things to do every week. Now what you might decide to do, and this is sort of almost be my recommendation now, is try and think of three things you can do each week, and then just do two of them. Because it's like the first day of a diet, you can feel too confident about how much you can do, and you discover that you can't do it all. So think of three things you can do, and then just do two of them, but really do those two things. And see if you can do something from the course every day, even if it's a tiny thing. The whole idea of this course is that you learn about this vision of life, as I think my blurb says on the book. I don't think I wrote the blurb, I can't remember. Anyway, or I might have written a bit of it. The worst thing to write, isn't it, blurbs? Anyway, it says, the big question is, how do you make the most of your life? So that's really what we call Buddhism, which I don't think is a very good word, because it sounds like an ism, like Marxism or conservatism or whatever. It's not an ism in that sense, it's not an ideology in that sense. What Buddhism is trying to do is ask that question, how do we make the most of our life? Which seems to me to be the question for us all, is how do we make the most of our life? That's what I want to do, and I would imagine that's what you want to do. It doesn't sound very metaphysical, doesn't even need to sound very Buddhist, but that is the question, isn't it? Not to be or not to be, but how do we make the most of our life? So to do that, you need to actually try and put it into practice. The more you can put into practice during the week, the more you'll get out of the course. Okay, so I want to start this evening's, I never quite know how I'm going to speak, but I've got an idea. I'd like to start every week with a bit of a vision of where we're going to go, and then a bit of a sense of how we're going to do that. So I thought I'd start a course by starting with the Buddha. So this figure on the shrine represents the Buddha. The Buddha was born as an ordinary person in northern India. What happened to him, according to tradition, and nothing was written down for hundreds of years after he died, what happened to him is that, according to the legend at least, he was in a palace, as they nearly always are in legends, and They never in small houses or semi-detached, are they? They're always in a palace. They live in a flat somewhere. Anyway, doesn't fit with that legendary world. I think the palace is actually an image for the self, basically. It's an image for our walled enclosure of me. I think we can probably best to read it fully poetically in that sense. Anyway, according to this legend, he's in this palace, he's not allowed to leave the palace. He disobeys his father, which we can think about all the symbolism of that. Goes outside the palace and he sees, first of all, three things. He sees, one time he sees a sick person. No, he doesn't. He sees an old person first, get the order right, and then a sick person, and then he finally sees a dead person. According to tradition, he's literally never seen these things before. I think probably what it's getting at, it's as if he never saw these things before. I mean, actually, we're all in exactly the same situation. All of us have seen old age, sickness and death, literally, but we may not have actually seen it at all, in the sense that we've not really seen what it means. Like just today, I went out I live upstairs, went outside to go for a walk with somebody, and someone had been knocked down in the street. And, you know, the person was still lying on the ground, and there were police and ambulance there. Just knocked down in the street. There you go, that's the sight. Yeah. That happens. It happened just this morning. There was a fight outside here, I think yesterday, that sounded terrible. That happens, yeah. So, whether we like it or not, and probably we don't like it very much, we live in a world in which old age, sickness and death are three of the marks of life. Yeah. So it's best to think that the Buddha-to-be actually saw them. I think it's probably more like he actually really saw the import of it. We see things, we notice things, but we don't notice them very much, do we? Like I could see that and go for a walk with my friend and talk about other things. It did bother me a bit, but that bothering soon quietens down, doesn't it? I don't know whether I don't watch the news anymore, I used to, and you know that strange experience when you watch something terrible on the news and then you get the adverts. Before you know it, you're thinking, I must buy that sweater. You know, we live in this strange way in which we can know something and not know something. So we know that we're going to grow old if we're lucky. We're actually not necessarily even going to grow old, but we know that if we're lucky. We know that we'll be sick at some time. We probably already have been. And we know that we're going to die. And yet, what do we mean by know? When you think about it, it's quite odd, that idea of knowing. It's a very odd thing, this whole question, I think, of knowing. We say we know them, but we don't act as if we know them. And actually, what we do much of the time, even most of the time, is forget them. Which, when you consider it, is very odd. You know, if you were having to explain the human situation to an alien, and you said, yeah, well, you end in death, they'd say, and then, oh yeah, but we forget that all the time. They say, you forget that? You know, there's only one thing you know will definitely happen. The only one thing you know will happen is the thing you forget. It would be very difficult to explain that, wouldn't it? You say, well, so you don't know then? No, I do know, but you forget. You know, and you act like, yeah, you're like, stupidly and foolishly, and yet, how can you do that when you go to die? Yeah? So, of course, in the traditional story, Siddhartha, that he's not the Buddha yet, Siddhartha, a young man, goes out, sees these three things, really sees them, fully sees them, and then according to this legend, he also sees a fourth sight. He sees a wandering holy man. Which again, what that really is getting at, is he sees the possibility of a solution to the problem of life. So what I think I wanted to start off with, slightly bracingly, is to start with the fact that life has within it an ineluctable problem. You didn't want that problem in your life, you didn't decide to have that problem, but life has in sown throughout it an ineluctable problem, a problem that you can't get round. That the one thing you definitely don't want to happen to you will happen to you, and you don't know when. Yeah, you have no idea when. You couldn't be in a more alarming situation. You think it isn't going to be like really relaxing, like really distressing, you might want to start changing your sense. Yeah? When you think of it, we couldn't be in a more alarming situation. You know, there is one thing that we really don't want to happen, and we've no idea when it will happen. So that is like a problem, capital P. Yeah? What makes us, in a way, that problem is what makes us human. The closer we are to that problem, we become more human. Today, for instance, I was reading a poem by Tom Gunn, American poet, who was the first person to write at length about his friends dying of AIDS. He writes his beautiful elegies about his friends dying of AIDS. And what struck me reading the poem is that because death was all around him, all these young people just suddenly dying, right? Suddenly going from being healthy and young to dying. He's an incredible grief in these poems, but there's also a remarkable kind of aliveness. It's as if by stepping closer to the facts of life, he actually became greater himself, in a way. The best poems he ever wrote, I think. So, realizing that life has this problem written all the way into it is an absolutely sort of is a human matter. But the trouble is, if we don't have this foresight, what you end up with is a sort of terrible nihilistic nightmare, don't you? Basically, if you don't have this foresight, all you might as well do is have fun till the lights go off, which is our Western philosophy, really, is enjoy yourself as much as possible because it's going to end. Which doesn't really work. If it did, I'd be doing it. I've been distracting myself. I think that's what I should try again. You know. So what that foresight is, what's called the wandering holy man, it's not a very good way of putting it, it's just a glimpse. Even a glimpse of a glimpse. And it's interesting, in the legend, he only sees this person very, very briefly, and then they disappear. Which I think is a perfect metaphor for, at times, we glimpse a new kind of way of being in the world, in which old age, sickness and death are not the problems we think they are. Now, what we're trying to do is actually have the both. We need a greater sense of these three signs, old age, sickness and death. And then we need a sense, and I think what we need most, actually, is a sense of something going beyond that. But in the modern so-called West, wherever that is now, we've lost so much sense of anything that goes beyond that. So we've ended up with sort of a nihilistic picture. And many people, the reason they come along to a Buddhist centre like this is something to do with those three signs. So it certainly was for me. Like, when I was eight, my grandmother died. I was very close to my grandmother. She sort of doted on me. I know it's hard to believe. I remember she asked me to colour in she had a drawing book, and I coloured in a goose. I remember colouring it in bright yellow. And I didn't go over the lines at the age of five. And she thought that, you know, I was bound to be the next Michelangelo on that basis. So she rather doted on me. So I was very close to her. I used to go around every day. Then she died. She was 92 or something. And my parents, unusually, decided to take me and one of my brothers over to see her dead body in the bedroom. Quite enlightened of them, really. I'm very grateful to that. And I was terribly young. I think I was six or something like that, possibly a bit older. And I remember going into the room, and I remember the oddness of being in my grandmother's bedroom. My grandmother always used to wear black, and she was always in a particular room surrounded by very large Alsatians, but that's another matter. Like some sort of queen with these two very large Alsatians, like two wolves next to her. a bit odd but going in her bedroom. And I remember my father or my mother saying, oh, she's asleep. And I remember even as a child thinking, no way is she asleep. I'd seen her asleep, and she definitely didn't look like that when she's asleep. I mean, I really remember thinking, she is definitely not asleep. And then I think my mother might say she's gone to a better place. And I'm thinking, I have no idea. But what struck me very forcibly, even at that age, is that here was something that I did not know about at all. I didn't understand. It seemed to me a colossal problem. You know, I didn't realise it then, but not only was it an emotional problem, it was a metaphysical problem. Something overwhelming, something utterly unknowable had happened. And I instinctively realised my parents didn't know about it either. They didn't, you know, what they said about it. They didn't know. So I think somewhere it's been that was one of my, I've had many sights in my life. One of them was that. And it's even that experience at that time somehow started to make me ask questions about the nature of life, about what life was for, where it was going, what was the point of career, what was the point of money, what was the point of status. All those ancient issues, what is the point of so much if it ends there? Yeah. Now that to me seems to be an absolutely central human question. Now, what you get in Siddhartha and the Buddha is someone who sees right the way through those things, sees them and knows them right the way through, in a way that we can barely imagine. Yeah? And he also has this glimpse of a way beyond that. The rest of his story is a working out of that. But he has a glimpse of the way beyond that. And as the course goes on, we'll try and talk about that glimpse, about the way beyond. Yeah. But what strikes me, first of all, is that why don't the facts of life touch us more? Why aren't we transformed by them? Why do we, and I mean us all probably, still get into silly states of mind, still watch rubbish on television, or, you know, do that thing when you're flicking through the Facebook feed, seeing more photographs of kittens, or Blossom at the moment, or whatever it is. You know, why do we do that? Why do we get into arguments? Why do we make a fuss about things when somehow we know about those facts? Why don't the facts of life touch us more deeply? Why don't we change because of that? Because that's what happened to Siddhartha. He changed. He changed his whole life on the basis of seeing those signs. I find it interesting, if you think of the palace being like yourself, somehow you have to leave a bit of yourself behind to see that. Otherwise, it's all about your own story. You don't really see the implications of what you've just seen. So one of the things I've talked about in the book is that I think one of the reasons we don't see it is because we don't have a fit mind. So the first task of any real human life, whether you want to be a Buddhist or not, or whatever you are, whoever you are, is to cultivate what I want to call a fit mind. I've used this metaphor because we're very used to having the idea of a fit body. We know the value of that. We also know you can't force yourself to have a fit body. You can't decide to be fit now. Okay, I'm going to have a fit body. And here it comes. You know, don't you, that you have to do stuff to get a fit body. You need to, like, move it about is one of the things, I believe. I don't do a lot of that, anyway. No, I did walk to a cafe today. We know the idea that we need a fit body. What we're much less aware of is that we need to develop a fit mind. So the first 4 weeks of this course are really about trying to cultivate a fit mind. A mind, and I like this metaphor of thinking of a mind that's fit for purpose, which is fit for the purpose of living a thoroughly worthwhile, decent, deepening, valuable, connective human life. Yeah? Big enough purpose as it is without bringing in a large gold figure for the moment. You know, how do we actually live the life we really want to live rather than plan about things or think stuff in our head? Yeah. How do we actually live, yeah? A fully worthwhile human life? So the first 4 weeks of the course are just about that. How do we cultivate what I want to call a fit mind? And just like cultivating a fit body means it can't be forced, it means that you need to do something every day, you need to do something regularly to develop a fit mind. Yeah? So the first, there's two great sort of aspects of a fit mind. The first one is integration, what I want to call integration. I've written a lot about this in the book. So integration, I mean, what, again, going back to that story of the Buddha, what strikes me is that seeing those things really deeply affected him. I think it's possible that you could read the story as, because he saw those three things and really saw them, he saw a way beyond them. You don't need to actually posit another thing. If you really see into the mystery of old age, sickness and death, because it is a mystery, nobody knows what happens when you die. I don't know what happens when you die, and nor do you. We have ideas about what happens when we die, we have beliefs about it, but nobody actually knows. The closer you get to it, it's more and more of a mystery. So the reason those things affected him so much is because he was surely because he was there, because his whole being was present in that experience. What he saw affected how he was, how he felt, his beliefs about what you do, his beliefs about agency and so on. If we're going to learn the lessons of life, and the great lessons are out there in life all the time, it's not that you need to come into this room and learn them. Life is trying to teach us about the nature of reality all the time. One of the reasons why we don't learn those lessons is because we can't attend to them. We're not really here. We're sort of elsewhere, aren't we? We're off somewhere in our mind, we're planning to do something, we're looking into a screen most of our life, and then when we stop looking into that screen, we look into another screen. So the first thing to do is to integrate ourselves, is to become more whole, more complete, more unified. Actually, interestingly, one of the first things you discover when you try to practice this is you often discover that you're not integrated. That you can be coming here tonight thinking, yes, I really want to do this, sounds really great, I'm going to meditate tomorrow morning, and then tomorrow morning you have a lie-in. Because somebody else is in charge tomorrow morning. Or, I don't know, you feel that this is really a valuable thing to do, and then somebody else gets in charge. We're not really one self. We're usually a whole collection of selves, aren't we? A whole crowd. Sometimes not in much communication with each other. So the first thing we need to do is cultivate this wholeness, this completeness, which has got this sense of unity rather than fragmentation, inner harmony and integrity, a kind of inner momentum. Yeah? So that's what we're looking to develop first. This sense of unity, harmony, wholeness, being more on the ball, being collected rather than distracted, dispersed, and so on. Only then will life be able to touch us deeply, because we're actually there for it to touch us. If we're not really giving our attention to something, or we've only got a bit of our attention to give, then life isn't going to affect us very much. We'll just sort of pass through it. I mean, the place, as I say, that you experience that most, and that I experience that most, is on retreat, because you put yourself in conditions where you can work with your mind a lot and your mind can really change. So that's the first thing we're going to be developing. For these first 2 weeks, we're going to be cultivating this first great aspect of a fit mind, which is integration. So I wanted to suggest three ways to cultivate integration. Then I'm going to get you to talk about it in pairs, about how you're going to do it. And then we might finish with a bit more meditation. So, the first thing we need to practice for this week, that how can I put this, is well, the Buddhist word which I've used in the book is prapancha, which means mental proliferation. I mean, many of you have come here, I would imagine, because your mind is noisy, because you're always thinking stuff, because even when you try to enjoy a meal or a good conversation or a meditation, you keep going off, you can't settle, you can't stay there. This has probably been increased for many of us because so much of us are spending so much time on technology, which is making us even more and more cerebral. So the first thing we need to practice is stepping out of all the stories in our mind, success stories, catastrophe stories, planning, ruminating, remembering, forgetting, planning again, and so on. First thing we need to start to cultivate is stepping out of that. And we step out of that into direct experience of the body. I'm talking about this metaphor of a fit mind. Mind is a bit problematic because it suggests just your thinking. A fit mind is a fit human being, a fit consciousness. But that includes body and emotions. So, the first thing we need to practice is stepping out of the puncture, as it's called, this mental chatter. Just keep stepping out of that into direct experience of the body. Now, I could just say, okay, well, let's do that for the week, and then come back and say how you got on. But you probably wouldn't be able to remember to do that. Yeah. You might remember just by the time you get to your coat, and then it'll go again. Yeah? So what I'm going to be suggesting is that you do these three breathing spaces every day. They just take 3 minutes. I explain them in the book, I can't remember which page, but I explain them in the book. And I'd like you to do three of those every day, and we'll finish one of those today. So all that is a little space in your life to practice noticing what's going on in your mind, practice stepping out of it into direct experience of your body. So even as you're sitting here, you can start to do that now. You can still be listening to me and start to notice the weight of your body on the cushion. And I can, as I talk to you, I can still be talking to you, I don't need to stop talking to you, and I can start to notice the weight of my body on the chair. I can start to notice my hands touching each other. I can even feel my feet on the floor. As soon as I start to do that, slightly changes my sense of myself, and as soon as you start to do that, slightly changes the sense of yourself, doesn't it? As you listen, you can then just feel where your hands are, the heat of your hands or coolness of your hands, where your feet are. And I can do that without, you know, suddenly getting all spiritual like that to do it. I can just sort of do it, and I can keep talking to you, but it sort of changes things. So as soon as I become more aware of my body, it changes my sense of myself. And as soon as you become more aware of your body, your sense of yourself slightly changes, doesn't it? So you can do this. If you've got a difficult meeting that you're going to tomorrow, you can just notice this while somebody else is talking. You can just come back to this sense, like you are now, see if you can feel the weight of your body on the cushion, feel your feet. As soon as you do that, your mind state slightly changes. And that's what we're going to be practicing in mindfulness. Very, very simple. There's lots more to say about mindfulness. It's very, very simple, but you can do it, can't you? You can do it on the tube going home tonight. You can do it in that meeting you're going to tomorrow. You can do it when you're watching the credits of the cinema. If you go and see Jungle Book, which is very good. That's a tiger. Anyway, I wish I wouldn't make you jokes. You can make jokes and still feel your body. So that's the first thing, but I want you to try and do it in these three breathing spaces a day. Try and do three a day. So that's the first thing I would like you to do this week. The second thing I wanted to suggest is, I think, which is something just as important, is to develop a healthy mind, to develop a fit mind, you do need to develop a fitter body. One of the reasons why we started doing yoga and qigong and things like that here at the centre is because so many of us are just living in the thoughts in our head. One of the classic ways of getting out of that is doing some kind of exercise. So you might start to think about exercising more. Are you exercising enough? Are you actually attending to a fit body as well as a fit mind? One of the ways that you might do that, you know, is your diet and that. Just try and think about how you could have a fit or a fitter body this week. Decide to go swimming twice a week, whatever it is you need to do. What I'm suggesting here is that you also have a mindful meal. You choose one meal that you do every day and try and actually be mindful of eating. It's usually easier if it's a meal if you're on your own, or if you're with someone, if you're sharing with someone, see whether you can get them to do it as well. Try and get mindful meals going, see if you can get a mindful meal. And the third area I want you to think about is what psychologists call mastery. So if mindfulness is the inner practice of integration, stepping out of papancha, mental proliferation, planning, fantasizing, remembering, thinking stuff. If the internal practice is stepping out of that into your body, the external practice is simplifying your life. So see if you can think this way, like this week, of ways in which you can simplify your life, which we would call cultivating mastery. So you might simplify your life, you might try and get things done that you know you've been putting off. Think of things like your desk at work. Think of things like your room at home. If you're constantly trying to find things, it means that your life isn't very simple. So see if you can think of a way of consciously simplifying your life so that your life runs more smoothly so that you can practice mindfulness. Yeah. I've written much more about this in the book, so do have a look. Yeah? But those are the three areas I want you to do this week. What we're trying to do is we're trying to get to the heart of life. Well, I started with Buddha because I wanted to start with this vision that there is, we have got a problem, capital P, right in the middle of our life. We couldn't have a bigger problem. That demands a solution, really. If we're honest with ourselves and honest with the problem, it demands a solution. The Buddha represents, if it were, that solution. So there's some kind of vision of a life in which old age, sickness and death are not what we think they are. But at the moment, we can't even usefully think about that stuff because we just think about it in our head, often disassociated from our emotions and our body. So the first thing we need to do is develop this fit mind. The first way I'm suggesting we do that is we keep on stepping out of papancha into the body. The second way I'm suggesting is that you do that as a mindful, this breathing space, 3 minutes, three times a day, and then try and have a mindful meal, and then try and simplify your life. So I want you to start the course really, really simple. I want to add in each week that you put time aside to read the book. So you're also really thinking about the issues of life, not just practicing. You want to be thinking about them and practicing them is the ideal. Yeah? So what I'd like you to do now is just go together in threes, something like that, and just between the three of you, decide how you're going to do that. Now you might decide, okay, I could do all three. You might do what I was suggesting at the start, just do two of them. So if you think you can do the mindful meal every day and the breathing spaces, and you can simplify your life by these things, perhaps just do two of those things. But really decide to do them. One of them needs to be every day. So if you think, okay, you could even just think, okay, I'll just do these three breathing spaces a day. But I will do them every day from now until next week so that I can come back and talk to the group about it. Yeah. So the rule of thumb for this course, I think, wants to be, let's decide what you think you can do, let's do less than that, but let's actually do it. Yeah. So go together in a three, think about what you can do, then think about what less you can do, and then talk about how you're going to actually do that, and then I'll draw us back together again and say a little bit more. Okay?